Good morning. I am part three of the lectures you're here. So again, my name is Ross Goldberg. I'm the chair of the Health Policy Advisory Council. We are the grassroots kind of arm of all this. If you think about the pillars, this is what we do. So all these wonderful things we're talking about, accomplishing what we're doing, doesn't happen without any advocacy behind it. So I want to go over kind of what our role is here in the whole process. So a little one-on-one for Surgeon's Voice and HPAC. We are an ongoing organized program to communicate, educate, and provide the tools necessary to build a strong network of surgeon advocates willing to take action on important health policy matters. So, again, grassroots networks, and really, it's the membership of the college that builds this. You know, I go around joking saying that I want the largest committee. The reason is that anyone can get involved and get active. And the idea is anyone should be involved. We're already patient advocates every day at work. This is kind of going at the next level, affecting our patients on this side of the aisle also. We can't just be talking about the hospital in the operating room. You're hearing about all the changes that are occurring. If we're not actively involved, things will be done to us instead of us being involved and helping make change. So advocacy is a key part of it. This is one of the ways you're able to participate, and we want to engage and get your input and feedback. So again, our purpose is to show its strength in numbers. When we go advocate, it's very different speaking on behalf of yourself versus a large group of people. That's a bigger bat you can swing, has significantly more impact. So the more of us that participate, the more powerful we can be. Our goals are simple: advocate, communicate, educate, and motivate. Whatever order you want. My job is to inspire those to get involved and want to participate. Anyone can be a member. If you're be a member of our committee, if you're a member of the college, you can be a member of the committee. It goes from leaderships all the way down to our new fellows, to our residents, to our medical students. We want to engage everyone and get them all involved. And again, we're broad-based, we're diversified, we're trusted, we're established surgeon advocates. If you heard throughout the meeting, we have a significant role in D.C. and the state legislatures. We come bringing solutions, not just problems. We do that through our advocacy efforts, and we all need to be involved. So just the components of what this is, HPAC is made up of the actual counselors or the state advocates, if you will. We cover a variety of different classes, specialties, states, you name it. We have online resources. We have our legislative calls to action, which if you've ever gotten an email, which is to click here and send a letter or a message to your member of Congress on a specific issue. We've got a new feature I'll talk about, kind of our at-home in-district, where you don't have to go very far to still have impact on your state and federal representatives. And then we have our other things like the Advocate of the Year, which we just started rolling out, and our regular communication and engagement opportunities. The nice thing about HPAC is a lot of it is digital. A lot of it is you can do it from home. We did that on purpose to make it as easy as possible. We understand everyone is busy, but I would argue this is just an important piece of your daily activities and anything else. And so we're trying to make it as seamless as possible for you. So a little history. The HPAC was actually founded in the 97th Clinical Congress, was voted into existence. So 2011, first chair was Charles Mabry. Again, the concept was we needed an advocacy wing, a grassroots network within the college to be effective and get our voices across. And that's really our goal. Our goal is to get our members involved, educated, and so they can go on advocate on behalf of our patients and our profession. Membership, it's really easy. If you want to be involved, just tell me and you're in. It's like the easiest process to get involved in the college. We, again, always just make it easy. Literally, you're all in the room here now. Congratulations, you're all going to be members before you leave. And what's going to mean is that you're going to participate. I told you I want the biggest committee, but I want the biggest active committee. There's a difference between membership and involvement. And one thing we're making sure of as I've taken over is that we're going through and making sure that each person who's on the council is involved and participates in activities. That way, it's not just saying, oh, I'm a member of this. We want to be active and show results. So again, membership leads to involvement, but also gets you more engaged and helps you treat your patients on another level that you haven't thought you could do before. Currently, we make up 157 members. Like I said, that list is growing. We have 9 new members, recently 48 states, 13 specialties represented, 5 residents so far, 7 young fellows. We liaison to a variety of different organizations. I'm kind of the representative from HPAC to Legislative Committee. We reach out to RAS, the Board of Governors. And one thing we're going to be doing this year is really try to coordinate our efforts better. There are different advocacy pockets within the organization, and we're really going to try to coalesce and bring that under one umbrella to really make sure that our efforts are well coordinated and the message is brought across. And again, who can join HPAC? You can. Really easy, just tell me you're interested. That's literally all you have to do. You can tell me now, you can tell me later. Other questions I frequently get asked, you know, again, what is grassroots advocacy? Again, it's the we're on the ground, right? We're there doing the day-to-day work, taking care of our patients. We know what's going on. We can tell the stories because that's what all advocacy is, building relationships and telling stories to these individuals that make these decisions, to put it in perspective for them. Easy to make a concept like a new code, a new bill, but if you tell them the real-life implications and what happens, it has a different spin on it, and it's very effective. So again, the grassroots network is all of us really on the ground level doing this work, communicating with one another and helping one another. Who are grassroots advocates? Again, the members of our organization are our grassroots advocates. You're an advocate already in the hospital for your patients, whether you're fighting with another service line about getting someone treatment, or you're fighting with your administration about a variety of reasons that we always like to fight about. This is, again, another issue you can bring about to talk to members who have impact on a broader level. Grass tops really are those super users. It's really what you want to aspire to be when you become an HVAC, is someone who's already engaged and has a little more understanding and realizing what's going on and can help teach others. The only way this really works is grassroots and advocacy really works in that one-to-one building relationships. So obviously I can't go around to every member of the Congress and try to do this. It would even exhaust someone like me. So I need help, and that's what these grass tops people are for, is to really, you have kind of your own area and you know the people you work with, you know them well, you can help educate and guide them. It's just like how we do, we teach our residents, we teach our medical students, it's the same kind of concept. Your elected officials, again, it's easy to go online to find out who represents you, both on the state and the federal level. The online, we have resources, it's really easy to check. You literally can just type in your address and ask who's my congressman, and there's about 100 different websites that would tell you. A grassroots call to action. It's something that we send out. It's a message from the American College of Surgeons. There is some issue going on, some bill that's in Congress, something that's going to happen that we need you to tell your representative or your senator to please either vote or don't vote for and why. And we try to make it really easy. So if all of you, I mean, I see everyone has a phone, and everyone, I'm sure, knows how to use a mouse because we all have electronic records now, right? So at least one finger works, right, so you can click. And that's all you have to do, is we send you a message, and a couple clicks later, you've sent a message to your representative. But again, the more we do that, the more they hear from us, the more of an impact we can have. If you want to know where someone stands, where your lawmaker stands, we have resources on our website, and I'm going to talk about the Surgeon's Voice component in a bit. But you can also go onto their websites on the houseandsenate.gov and see where they stand on certain issues. They list it front and open. They don't hide it. They can't. They want you to know where they stand. You could find out what they voted for on certain issues. You want to know who you're dealing with. I know where my representative stands on certain things. He and I don't always agree on anything, on everything, not anything. Every once in a while we agree, but occasionally. But I know where he stands, so I also know how to frame the argument when I want to come talk to him about an issue. Like, I know what will and won't work because I know what he's focused on. He's focused on technology. He's focused on opioids. He and I have common ground when we talk about how to treat the opioid epidemic. Maybe I don't talk to him about other things because I know he and I won't move much further, but the opioids I can. And how do you know if the ACS is working on an issue? Well, besides hearing come to these lectures, you can go online and look. We have tons of information on our website to update you on what's going on and what we're doing. So a little metrics. Again, the current ones, if you went on right now to Surgeon's Voice, is our call to actions that you can do right now, and I encourage all of you to do it. You can even do it from your phones. Again, those are the five, and literally it lists a little bit of information. Once you register onto Surgeon's Voice and you hit a click and it sends it to your representative or senators, and we're talking about PAPA, we're talking about ensuring access to general surgery. The colorectal cancer screening was actually a pretty popular one with the representatives and senators. Again, supporting that access. We have palliative care up there, and we also have the liability protections for EMTALA mandated care. These are not everything we cover, but these are the current issues that we would want people to participate and send a message. The nice thing is you can personalize that message if you want. That does have more effect. But if you don't and you just want to do your standard click, literally two clicks later and you're done. So imagine if everyone did that. Right now, a lot of members of the college do not participate in this. They look at it and go, why should I bother? Why do I care? Well, you care when someone messes with your practice, right? You know, in politics, it's all about the one-liners. I've gotten a few of them myself now, learn how to communicate. One of the ones I like to tell people why I'm so involved is that I'm really good at messing up my own life. I don't need help. And right now, there's lots of people that want to help. And so I need to get them out of my operating room and stop messing with me. So I communicate with them to explain to them why I need to be able to do my job. So if you don't like something, the only way to fix it is to participate. Just to sit in the back and say, this isn't fair, this isn't right, You're adding to the white noise. You're adding to, you're not helping, you're making the problem worse. So I challenge everyone to participate to help fix the issues. One thing we have seen already in our advocacy efforts is that we're getting more support. So co-sponsors are important, right? These are senators and representatives who will sign on and support a bill that we ask them to support. By co-sponsoring, it's a public acknowledgement, not just they say, yes, we agree. They're letting everyone know that this is an issue they feel strongly on and they're going to support. We have had a bunch of new co-sponsors on our legislation through our advocacy efforts, and not all from the same players. We have good relationships with some, and we're building new relationships with others. Again, I keep going back to building relationships. That's what this is. So you see some list there of House representatives and senators on both sides of the aisle who work with us on our issues. And we have done a very good job of really making inroads and creating new relationships along the way. Social media is a big part of it, obviously. So this is from the last Legislative and Advocacy Summit earlier this year. The nice thing on the left, you should see one. You can go to at Surgeon's Voice. You should all be following it on Twitter, at Surgeon's Voice. And you see on the left someone posting how they met with Senator Leahy and how great a meeting it was. But the organic response on the right-hand side is from a representative talking about that the American College of Surgeons came and talked to them. So we are making an impact, and they're going out and talking about it and telling how we are interacting and engaging. Again, we try to communicate any way we can. You see on the left side another one from a representative talking about the Stop the Bleed effort. And you see our own Dr. Frank Opelka testifying, and we like to give you information regarding that. He was talking about MIPS and giving out feedback to a subcommittee. And again, ways where we communicate and to show what's going on. So little updates on what's coming up. This one I'm most excited about, and I think is really our chance to have significant impact. It's our new Advocate at Home program. It's literally that. So I live in Phoenix, right? Going to D.C. is not around the corner trip for me. That's a couple days just to get there and back. This gives me the ability to participate with my representatives at home, on home base. Literally, we do a lot of the legwork. You tell us you're interested. We can't read your minds. We need to know that part. We work with you on what days are available for you and coordinate with your representative's office when they're back in the district, usually during either a break or whenever there's times that can be worked out. We send you some material. We literally schedule the appointment for you. Then you go and you meet with your representative of Congress. It really are fantastic meetings we found so far. Actually, better meetings than in D.C. In D.C., a lot of times, they're really cramped with their schedules, right? If any of you have done it, they're short windows. It's nice to meet with them, but it doesn't last very long. These have been averaging 45 minutes to an hour with the member of Congress, not just sitting there and talking about stuff. And people have been really excited about it because they really can get into deep discussions and have great interactions with people. And again, the example I used, I set it up for one day so that it was in the end of my working day. I went to clinic that day. When I was done with clinic ended a little early. I drove to my representative's office in Scottsdale. I met with him for about a half hour to talk about stuff, myself and another surgeon, and then I went home at the same time I normally went home. So it really didn't impact my day at all. I still went to work, still saw, took care of my patients, and then still was able to lobby, and it all was done quite easily. And then we give feedback back to the staff to see how it went. So I encourage all of you to think about this and look for it. We want to keep on doing this. Obviously, we're not setting up any meetings for the next couple of weeks. And once we figure out who's where in the House and the Senate, we'll get that going for you. Again, these are just some at-home testimonials about really how people found the great interaction. It's been a lot more robust, I think, than people expected. And you get a lot, you make a lot of headway. And again, building relationships. Once your member of Congress knows who you are and knows what your interests are, they'll reach out to you for issues. I have given feedback to numerous congressional districts in Arizona regarding opioids. They ask me to review specific legislation because they know I'm engaged and involved. It's even actually here in Massachusetts I had another congressman reach out. So if you show interest, they will reach out to you to get your feedback. Looking ahead, we're going to continue with the program. We're developing new materials online for you. We always want to give you tools and show it's easy to be done and teach you how to do it. We, again, have the new Advocate of the Year. We gave our first one out this year. Again, it's those super participants. We always like to reward and acknowledge those that participate and work very hard for us. You, too, can get a golden megaphone, and it really was a megaphone. It really did work. I highly recommend it if you want to look for next year. And then they'll be looking for more improvements on Surgeon's Voice. It is now within the website of the college. So there's the website up there, facs.org/advocacy/Surgeon's Voice. There's a mobile component. It is very easy to do. Once you register, you are locked in. And literally, it's point and click. And you have information on there for issues. You have information about how to send calls to action. I encourage all of you to go on it. You can do it from your phones. You can do it right now while we're talking. I won't mind if you're looking at your phone to do that. So ways to engage. Attend our leadership summit coming up at the end of March, beginning of April. Become educated about our policies. Now, I know the common response back is, well, I don't know everything about the topic. I promise you, neither does the member of Congress. You probably know more about it than they do, given your experience, which is okay. You don't need to be and quote everything about a bill. What you're there to do is to provide stories and perspective on what's going on. I'll tell you, in politics, they really like the story. You tell them a story, and it's a good one, and it brings a point home, most likely that politician will steal it and use it themselves later on the road to talk about their constituents and what's going on. It's the stories that matter. We're there to put perspective on what's going through with us and our patients. That's why you're doing this. You want to use social media, learn about your legislators. Again, become a member of HPAC, represent your state. Join our Advocate at Home program. And then the other one also, obviously, is the Surgeons PAC. I know these kind of overlap, but the Surgeons PAC is the Political Action Committee for the American College of Surgeons Professional Association. It's the fundraising arm. You know, there's money involved to building relationships. It's kind of the way of the world. So you have to participate not just with your actions, but with your dollars as well. And the more we can participate, the more we get involved, is how we engage members of Congress. Recruit others. So I have homework for all of you now. I know you all, everyone loves homework. You're going to go home and not just participate. You're going to find five friends to do it too. Five surgical colleagues I want to also get in line and get involved. The more of us to get involved, A, the less work you have to do because more people are doing it, but the greater voice we can have. We already have significant impact now. Imagine if everyone participated. Host a tour. If you really want to make sure you meet your member of Congress, you know, you can always deliver a PAC check. They like coming and picking those up, and they have no problem, and they'll talk to you about issues then because no one ever says no to money. So, again, ways to interact and ways to get their attention. If you ever have any questions, feel free to reach out, call, contact, email, yell at me, whatever you want. I'm always available and able to help. Katie Ullman and Michael Carmody are our two staff members really talking about Surgeon's Voice and our fundraising and grassroots effort. I thank all of you for coming this morning. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you to Jim and to Linda and to Ross. We've left plenty of time here for questions this morning so that we could hear from you. So if you'll come to the microphone, then we'll address your question to the appropriate expert.
I think while people are thinking of their burning questions, just a reminder that out on the table, there are a few of the Employed Surgeon's Handbook there for you to take. So please grab one. And just to let folks know that in these practice management related topics, sometimes it's information that you've sent us. You've made a telephone call saying that the insurance companies are doing something sneaky in your neck of the woods, and it allows our resources to explore it and figure out if it has more of a national implication and how these things are going on. And this is the way that we get the information so that we can get on it right away when there's trends that are distasteful to us happening across the country.
Hi, thank you. Little bit of background real quickly. My name's Aaron Blesnack. I'm a surgeon down in Norfolk. For the last 10 years, I've been in executive leadership roles with healthcare organizations and medical groups. So I applaud you on the book for employed physicians. By the way, there are surgeons, there aren't any copies out there. And I'm hoping, since I've spent 7 years learning about and instituting compensation models, I'm hoping that you had some members, some of the enemies involved in the crafting of the document. So yesterday we heard a lecture by Dr. Porter on the strategies to save healthcare. I don't know who attended it. It was out by the Harvard Business Review about 5 years ago. And one of the things he talks about, one of the keys, is really moving away from traditional academic medical disciplines and recognizing that if we focus on patient centricity, it's going to be cross-disciplinary. So I guess a question I have for you, having gone to Washington and advocated in the past for ACS positions, is how are we doing this on the legislative and advocacy side, because I think if we continue to do things the way we always have before, we're not going to change the course of healthcare in time, and I think we're very rapidly moving towards a crisis situation.
Frank, you want to say a few words since you were the porter?
So, Frank Opelka, and I'm in the Washington office as staff, and thank you for your question. It's we could have a whole session on this. In fact, we could have probably have a half a day on this. So it's how can I just make this concise? The payer community, the purchaser community, the legislative community at large pretty much feel that this fee-for-service transactional business that we have is fully efficient and going at full steam and breaking the bank. They're looking for a higher value for the dollar spent. And so Dr. Porter has really defined that in everyone's mind, and everyone in Washington believes what Dr. Porter has espoused, that care isn't what it was 30 years ago. It's a lot more complicated. Patient came in with appendicitis. They got an operation. They went home. Now there's all this pre-op stuff that we do. There's all kinds of imaging options, and then there's a rehab protocol, and there's home care and skilled nursing and all these other things, and not even to mention all the different pharmaceuticals that are out there. So care is so much more complicated today than it was 30 or 40 years ago. And each one of those complicating, confounding matters is another transaction. It used to be the hospital bill, the anesthesiologist, and the surgeon, and maybe a pathologist. Now there's advanced imaging, and then there's more in home health and skilled nursing. When you look at an event of care today, a typical surgical event of care today, there's 30 to 60 different tax IDs touching every surgical procedure. It's staggering. So what the business side is saying is, clinically, you've grown and changed, and you're a lot more complicated than you were when we first invented fee-for-service. We still have the business logic from 50, 70 years ago, and the clinical logic has moved to a much more complex animal. So how do we actually redesign the business logic to fit into the current clinical logic? That's question number one. Porter's answered in his model. And he basically doesn't believe in ACOs. He believes in bundles, basically. And the second part of this is we're still paying all physicians, but surgeons included, in the old business model. You're still tracking RVUs. You're still tracking transactions all over time. And everyone pretty much agrees that's not the way to do it. But nobody has said, well, how am I going to do it? So until they do, who's going to move? What surgeon in their right mind would move off of where they are until they know where they're going? So, and that's a conversation I've actually had with Dr. Porter. It's a conversation we've had with CMS, Blue Cross, United, Aetna, and others. If you want surgeons to move, and a surgeon is making X dollars a year, how do I keep that stable in a new business model? Because you're not going to move otherwise, and I wouldn't move either. That's the big unknown. That's the elephant in the room. And that's what everyone is sitting here now, scratching their head, saying, what makes sense to you, the way you practice? How do I make a business model align with the way you practice? Can I appreciate you as the captain of a team? And can I pay the team? And will I know you're fairly paid? And that's what they're starting to try and figure out in bundles. But bundles are still subunits of fee-for-service. And so there's real questions of what does value-based compensation look like? I can give you value-based payment, but I'm paying this entity that's got a team around it. What does value-based compensation look like? We don't know. So that's the policy question, and that becomes a regulatory question once we answer it, and it becomes a legislative question. But the first part of it is principally what's the business logic behind this? Does that answer your question?
So first of all, thank you very much for the explanation. My question was actually a little bit simpler than that, which was a question of when we go to Washington, the work that we're doing, how are we increasing our collaboration with other specialties? Because I think if we continue to keep going, we're the surgeons, they're the internists, they're the anesthesiologists, we don't speak with a unified voice and we don't offer an alternative to Congress.
So as long as we're in a transactional zero-sum game, we have a natural tension. And so we will always oppose each other in zero-sum. And Porter writes about this as well. The real object is, how do we build a joint solution? Now, our natural partner is anesthesia, and then on top of that, probably hospitalists, and then you can start to build out from there path and imaging. If we build a cooperative effort between surgeon and anesthesia as the first effort, and maybe throw in the hospitalists who are eager to work with us, and we start telling a story about the patient's surgical journey and how we can make it better and more cost affordable and good for surgeons and good for anesthesia and good for the hospitalists, we can craft a joint message and have a conversation. And the payer community would love that to happen. We're not terribly far from that. But once you get outside of the immediate sphere of surgery, there's still this transactional world, and there's still this natural tension between payment for primary care versus surgery. And it's not helpful for anyone. What I really hate to hear inside the Beltway is when somebody says, we're the cognitive physicians. And I really like to turn to them and say, we're not. We're just the surgeons. And it exposes them for what they're saying. But that's attention we don't need. It's attention that Congress says, I can't deal with the two of you because you're not working together. So I'll just not deal with you. When we come together, Congress, the payer community, they listen because they're looking for solutions.
I have two questions. First, like what we are speaking about, the small private practice physicians, how would they fit in the juggernaut that is now with the hospitals taking over the practices and ACOs and all the alphabet soups which are there? How does that piece fit in with the rest when we are talking about this? That you give up one payment to the hospital and hospital will do, but I'm independent practitioner. I'm not hospital employee.
So no one's saying give the payment to the hospital.
Okay.
We're saying give the payment to the team. Now, if you build the team, the payment goes to the team, and you're part of the team. The issue that puts you at a disadvantage is the insurers are transferring risk. So they're saying, whoever is the team, you're going to take risk. Independent small physicians are risk averse. Hospitals are in the risk game. So you need a relationship with a risk-bearing entity. Now, what's happening in certain specialties is groups of small physicians are getting together to take the risk, and then finding those facilities or hospitals who are going to be their cost center to their risk model. Okay? So that's happening very much so in orthopedics. You might see a group of 130 orthopods who get together and cover half a state. But they're creating an entity. It's not their own personal corporation, but it's a shell company that's taking the risk. And then they partner with 10 or 15 different hospitals. So there are the single shingle physician can't stand alone and take risk. You've got to form other relationships if you want to take risk. If not, you're going to just provide a service to a risk-bearing entity somewhere. If it's an insurance company, so be it. That's fee-for-service. If it's an ACO, then you'll have that relationship. But the risk is being transferred, and you've got to figure out who's your risk partner.
The second question. There was a rule that emergency services would need to be compensated, would be compensated irrespective of the patient's coverage.
Right.
But we are being denied as patient is already in the hospital and you provide care to the patient who is in ICU. They need that care you provide. And the insurance companies are saying, no, that patient's insurance coverage is only for participating provider. You are not participating provider. And where do we go with that? There is nobody who is helping us when we call. And it is not a small chunk now because people are all in their groups and in their things. So what is the college's view on that?
I think we've been very involved in these issues going across the country. I'm not quite sure if you're talking about the issue of not being on a panel that's
recognized.
By
just as an individual physician, because I may be par with some, not par, and there are closed panels now. So even if you wanted to, if in my hospital a big chunk of patients, for example, are United Healthcare arbitrarily, then my panel is closed. You can't be on the panel. But I am a safety net hospital. Patients get admitted. They are in ICUs. They get flown in from order, and I provide care. And now they are saying, no, you are not in the panel, and we won't pay you.
I think we've looked at this at both levels. The closed panel system, which has caused issues in and of itself, and the other is how do we make sure that payments that patients aren't receiving extraordinary bills for services rendered for patients that are out of panels just because of the circumstances of where you live or your requirements being in an on-call service. We're aware of the issues, and I think there's a lot of activity in trying to work through the issues to make sure that that on-call services being provided by surgeons are seen as the necessity that they are, and that surgeons are fairly compensated for that work and protected from some of these insurance-specific arrangements that tend to clip surgeons out of the payment. So there is activity afoot. I can't give you one specific answer on how it's going to be fixed, but
is there somewhere we can approach the college? That's all.
Yes, you may, but I will weigh in. Linda is exactly correct on this. And this is actually a very hot-button issue at the current time. It's a hot-button issue in our practices. It actually has happened to become somewhat of a hot-button topic on the Hill, if you will. There is considerable concern about costs of care and transparency of costs. And, for instance, the Senate has actually put together a bipartisan working group that's looking at things such as cost of health care, cost of medications, network adequacy, and out-of-network care. And, in fact, several congressional offices are moving forward with actually creating bills that address things such as surprise billing for patients. And the college has been approached to look at some of those pieces of legislation. And the college has actually opined on some of those pieces of legislation. And the one thing that we recognize is that there are many, so to speak, facets to this problem. We are aware of the patient-centered problem, the patient who is taken to an out-of-network facility and now is facing a six-figure bill that is far beyond their means. But at the same time, we also believe that there's also the position of the surgeon, such as what you've described, who renders care to patients because they need that care at the time that it was administered, and they expect to see some form of fair payment for their services rendered. I don't have a solution for you. I'm not sure that the college as a whole has a solution for you at the current time, other than to say that we're aware of the situation and we're trying to basically make certain that individuals on the Hill understand that it's not just a one-sided problem. It's complex.
Just one other thing with that. I don't know if this is working. It's not just on the federal level. It's on the state level as well. I think everyone should go back and learn what law, if it's been passed in their states. Many states have legislation now dealing with some level, good or bad, the surprise billing, the network inadequacies, things like that. And we recently went through that in Arizona. You know, we talk about what we know. We recently passed legislation over the last couple of years dealing with arbitration, looking at the Texas model, things like that. So while the federal government's getting involved now, states have already started to do this. It's a very big issue on the state level. So again, my pitch back is to go learn about what's going on in your state and really start lobbying your representatives and tell them that story. Tell them of the sick patient in the ICU and a safety net hospital. I could work as one as well, so I understand it, where you're there to provide care. And yes, you know, you still need to be compensated for the time and efforts you put in for taking care of that patient. You know, now to spend double that time to fight to get compensated is a waste of your efforts. And they need to understand that. And the only way to do that is to educate them and to sit down and go over it. Because the laws, many are starting to look at it. So if your state doesn't have one, they will really soon. I don't be surprised if the other states don't start popping up with legislation this year, this upcoming year. So I'd highly recommend going that avenue as well.
Surprise denials either. There shouldn't be, especially for emergency care.
Just so you know, John, raise your hand. See that guy? So he is at the state level, and his office takes these kinds of issues on. I understand what Ross is saying, but it's hard for you in a busy practice to go do what he's saying. Our office does that legwork. We do the education, we research it, etc. So contacting our office on these kinds of issues, this one is very high on our radar. We've got a lot of work in this area. But it doesn't mean that it's going to flow on the regulatory side. It doesn't mean it's going to happen on the legislative side. And maybe it's going to happen at the payer level. But that John's office and his staff are bringing this at the state level. They work very closely with the AMA at the state level. So if you have those kinds of issues and make our staff aware, we can then share back with you our work. So that when, if you want to go visit with somebody, you're not going in empty-handed. You're going in with our backup.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
My name's Greg Antoine. I'm from. I work in the government sector, but I've been in private practice. I was in the military, and I read the Porter article. And I would refer you to another article that was published by one of his colleagues, Clayton Christensen, the innovative disruptor. And he talked about his journey when he got sick and he had to be hospitalized. And he didn't fully understand the complexity that was involved in taking care of a patient that was hospitalized. Dr. Porter comes at things strictly from a business sense. And that kind of makes sense. But the bottom line is that we are involved in healthcare, which is a human business. We're not making widgets. We're not fixing widgets. We're not ordering parts for widgets. Well, we're doing transplants, but we are. And I think that what gets missed also is that the cost of a medical education is not going down. And that is going to be continue to be transactional for people that, and we're a business that can't go out of business. GM can fail. Somebody else can make cars. You have to have surgeons. You've got to have doctors. The society, we've built a society that needs us. So I think that we have the moral high ground, and we also have to keep this tension between us and business. I never hear anybody say that Apple makes too much money. When they first came out with it, seems like everyone is trying to legislate us around, we pay too much for this and we pay too much for that. Well, when you operate on a patient, that's your patient. You've bought it for good, bad, worst, or whatever. And you have to take care of that patient. So the idea that when I first heard about, okay, well, we're not going to pay to readmit a patient if they have a complication. Is anybody never going to have a complication? I mean, that's humanly impossible. So, we should not be arguing around things that are not humanly impossible. Certainly, we can have a range, but to say, okay, you have to give us the money back because your patient had a post-operative complication. Sometimes I think the conversation borders on lunacy when you talk to these business people. And, I'm not trying to be funny or anything, but if you listen to their conversation, it's all about we pay you too much money. And what are we going to do about the kids who are following us who want to be surgeons? I think I read something yesterday. The average private medical school education is now close to 350,000. State school is 230,000. Those are factors that weigh into that. And I think that when we have these discussions with these businessmen and with our legislators, we should give them the whole package. Listen, this is what you're paying for. And, you've got to keep this train rolling, because if you don't have any surgeons, you're going to have a real problem in all specialties. So that's just a comment I want to make.
I thank you for that. And also, Dr. Christensen's books are exceptional books. I met with him earlier this week. He still struggles with his own illness. He still is getting along. To me, I look at everything you just said, and this transformation that's undergoing in healthcare right now has got a lot to do with the corporatization of medicine. And what keeps me up at night is, how do you preserve the soul? And that's the big challenge. You can overshoot and completely put this into the corporatization, and that's not why anybody really came here to do what they do. It's the soul of what we do in helping people get through an enormous challenge in their life and in our profession on this side of it as surgeons. So somehow, as we go through this transformation, we need the Clay Christensens of this world who remind us of the importance of the soul.
Time for one more quick question.
My name is James Macon. I'm a spine surgeon in Boston, and I am also a disciple of Dr. Porter. So he's not here. I'm going to speak for him. I think that his goal is to improve efficiency in and to achieve through business strategy a successful business outcome for medicine. It's a failing project right now under fee-for-service, and he feels that moving away from fee-for-service with this concept of value optimization is the way to go. And that makes a lot of sense. The value, as he said, would be the true north. He does not expect this to happen immediately. This is an incremental process. You're talking about decades. He'd like to have it happen tomorrow, and he'll talk to you about that being the way to go. Set up IPUs and various efficient systems of delivery, but nothing to fear here. This is going to be a slow process. What is important, though, and what I'm mainly interested in, is having surgeons understand what value is and where they can make a contribution, even though at this time you don't get rewarded for value optimization. So, for example, a simple way to optimize value is just don't do any unnecessary surgery. Because you know the equation for value is outcome divided by cost. And if you have a high cost for something that is not going to work or is not needed, then the value is zero. So if you eliminate, that's the low-hanging fruit. If that's where you start, just eliminate the low-hanging fruit, optimize your value as individuals, and you'll start to understand what the whole project is about. Dr. Porter's ideas are systemization and development of models for reimbursement. None of that's going to affect us in our, at least in my career.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, well, I'd like to thank all of you for attending this year's 10 Hot Topics, and we'll look forward to seeing you at a future session.